This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
So I'm staying in my own chair. Go on without me if you must.
Your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to episode 26 of TV Good Sleep Bad, your monthly dose of cool TV goodness. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
iPhone Tower!
And today's show, we are going to be paying a visit to some of the darker regions of British comedy as we take a look at Snuffbox, as well as in an earlier appearance from Matt Berry as we look at the IT crowd. But obviously, before we get into those two selections for this episode, I mean, we're probably best also asking as always is what you've been watching. I mean, like since the last episode, I mean, what has been holding your attention?
Well, one of the things that, and I don't know how much of a, I don't even know if you ever, if it ever was as big a thing over, I assume it wasn't as big a thing over in Britain as it was over here, but you probably had heard about the Roseanne reboot.
Yes.
And I was never a big fan of Roseanne Barr herself. That was the first thing that John Goodman did that became widely known, obviously. I liked him. I liked Laurie Metcalf, and I liked Sarah Gilbert. Like just about every other American 14-year-old at the time the show started, I had the worst crush on Sarah Gilbert, who I saw as this very sort of thing I always liked about Darlene Connor, was she was this, she was obviously a misfit, but that was kind of the time when the what I call the John Hughes paradigm of the American high school experience was starting to kind of take root in popular culture, where you would watch a movie set in high school and everybody basically belonged, everybody in the school belonged to one of these cliques. They were either a nerd or a preppy or a jock or a burnout or like a goth or what we'd call an emo now. And that was kind of like the Breakfast Club, which is kind of ironic because the entire point of the Breakfast Club was, you know, not to kind of judge by, you know, images. Yeah. And to basically say, yeah, like the high school experience is pretty much the same all around, no matter what clique you belong to. And the thing that I found very, like I said, very, very endearing about Darlene was how she was obviously a misfit, but didn't really belong to any of those cliques. Which I was very much the same way when I was in high school. A lot of people did see me as being a nerd, but I never felt really in with the brainy crowd because my grades weren't quite high enough, because basically I was a lazy student. But I always look at, like Darlene Connor was, when we talked about Daria a few episodes back, I had forgotten to mention Darlene Connor as kind of like another variation on the Daria archetype, the kind of, you know, wisecracking outsider. So four episodes of the Roseanne, I guess I shouldn't call it a reboot, but the Roseanne revival have aired, and I'm enjoying it for the most part so far. It is somewhat marred by Roseanne Barr's has gone full, as we say, MAGA. Yeah. Going on Twitter and talking about how David Hogg is, you know, being paid by, you know, a crisis actor being paid by George Soros and all that bullshit. but the chemistry between the characters is still there. And it's just always good to see, you know, like I said, Laurie Metcalf and John Goodman, Sarah Gilbert, all kind of playing off of each other. So I've been enjoying that. It's not amazingly great, but there are enough laughs, I think, to make it worth it. So there's been that. There's the X-Files obviously had its finale.
Yeah.
I don't know if we talked about I don't think the X-Files had run its finale by when we did the last episode.
We had a bit of a delay, and then we obviously had the Olympics, which meant that you had the break.
Right.
At which point we were still running. So by the end, I think we were like a couple of episodes behind. It's just been a real mess that Channel 5 essentially made of it, because they were showing it, and then the X-Fans over here were getting on their case and sort of bad-mouthing them, and they responded by putting it on even later for some reason.
Oh, boy.
It was a real bizarre strategy by Channel 5 on this one.
Yeah. But my recollection is that the last episode I had talked about the episode that's just basically Mulder and Scully running away from drones, which I thought was a brilliant episode and probably the best episode of the revival not written by Darren Morgan. There's really hadn't been anything left in the season that I think had really kind of reached that height of brilliance. The finale was a little bit of a mess. I don't go into any. I know well enough to not go into any episode starting with where the title starts with the words "My Struggle,"
yeah,
and really expect anything coherent. But it wrapped pretty much, I think, everything from the last couple seasons up into a nice kind of bow. Resolved, I think, everything needed to resolve. And if this is where they end up leaving the X-Files. Because Gillian Anderson has now been saying she's not going to be coming back as Scully. And whether or not that ends up holding true or not, time will tell at this point. But I think this is pretty much a very good way to a very good place to I think, leave things. If this is the last I see of this iteration of the X-Files, it's, I think, if not the most satisfying ending, then at least it's something I can live with.
Yeah, it's had an ending. And I mean, I've yet to watch the finale. I mean, I think the last one I watched was the one with the drones, so Followers. And I've enjoyed the Monster of the Week episodes. I thought they've all been really sort of fun. Like yourself, as soon as the word "My Struggle" is mentioned in an episode, I've just tuned out.
Right.
Certainly My Struggle Part 3, I think, has taken the character of the cigarette smoking man and essentially broke him in a way that I don't think you can repair it.
Yeah.
And I think it was took the series into an aspect that it didn't need to go. And
right.
It felt forced and it felt stupid. And I'm just glad that we had some decent Monster of the Week episodes. I mean, there's been some really interesting ideas. There's been some fun character ideas. I mean, we had the demonic Teletubby episode.
Oh yeah, that one I enjoyed that one.
Which I know what I'm dressing as for next Halloween.
Mr. Chucklebones.
Mr. Chucklebones. His. I mean, I think as anyone who's sort of knows myself would know that I'm a sucker for a good mask, and Mr. Chucklebones is right up there with anything we've seen in The Purge and like The Strangers and
I thought the introduction of that character, specifically that one scene where the kid looks out into the forest and he just Mr. Chucklebones just sticks his head out from behind a tree, I thought that was brilliant visually.
Yeah,
and I'm just like, holy crap, did that just happen?
I was just, what I really liked about Mr. Chuckbones is the attention to detail, because normally you have him, and I mean, he's there in the pinstripe suit and whatnot, and normally like the costuming department to like drop the budget and have him like wearing sneakers or something. And thankfully, they didn't do that. They bothered to give him the correct shoes, and it was those one little details I appreciated. So it was definitely a good one for myself. So,
you know, I think this is the best place to leave. Like I said, this iteration of the X-Files, I know a couple years ago, you and I had kind of hashed out like our vision for like the next generation of the X-Files, which would punt Mulder and Scully and the regular characters, the familiar characters, off to sort of like support roles and focus on new characters that are not Mulder and Scully. And in particular, the not Mulder and Scully of Einstein and Miller, who I was very glad Carter did see fit to bring them back this season, but thankfully they just had that one glorified cameo in the premiere. You know, that's just it's almost that one, those two particular characters, I always felt just like it was almost like Carter was not taking the concept seriously enough.
Yeah. I mean, I liked them. I they were inoffensive. I mean, certainly considered to some of the things we've seen over the show's run history, I mean, that they're probably one of the least offensive things that we've seen come out of this series. So I can't really begrudge them too much, but I know obviously there are people in the fan community who just want to keep it as Mulder and Scully. I think if Gillian Anderson continues with her sort of pledge not to come back, which at the moment I don't know if she will or she won't. I mean, a lot of people are saying that this is it for the X-Files, that it's not going to come back. I feel that it may be the case, like when we had the previous season, it's going to be go away for a bit and the actors are going to go off and do other projects, and then it's going to, you know, decompress and think, you know what, maybe I want to come back and do like a little mini series and see what else we can do with these characters. Maybe Scully will come back as a Zordon head like we saw with Ringo Langley. Maybe that's what she returned as in the if they come back in another series. I really have no idea, but for now I'm happy that it happened. It may not have been as perfect as perhaps we would have liked as fans, but it was interesting. It had enough interesting moments to make it a worthwhile venture for myself.
And particularly the finale, I think, gives it a little bit more of a sense of genuine closure than The Truth did, which was just, I felt, a weak episode all around and really not really a good moment to try to end the series on. There's a mini-series, a Ridley Scott-produced mini-series that is going on AMC based on the Dan Simmons novel The Terror, which stars Kieran Hines and Jared Harris, and is a historical horror series about the doomed attempt to find a northern passage up into the Franklin Expedition.
Okay.
With the Erebus and the Terror, they were trying to find a passage up the Northwest Passage up to that would basically go through the Arctic to connect like the the Pacific to the Barrier Atlantic through the St. Lawrence Waterway or something like that. And 129 men vanished, and it looks like the Terror pod this miniseries in the novel it's based on posits that it was some sort of monster that killed them all. Bully for that. So, I've watched a little bit of that. I kind of have to get back into it because I've been a little bit distracted lately. What about yourself?
For myself, I mean, it's not been a huge amount that I've really been sort of watching. I was recently on vacation, so I spent a lot of it catching up with ER. I decided to start rewatching that from the beginning. And I really forgot how good ER is. And it's a reminder as well of how certain shows just work better in America than they do here in Britain. like, when they announced that they were going to do the UK version of Law and Order, I just knew it wouldn't work because, you know, we have barristers and people with dusty wigs in court here. It's not like when we watch American Law and Order, where it's like sleazy lawyers and people in suits and stabling beatdowns on perps and stuff. It's a lot more exciting to watch the American one than the sort of standards set by British crime drama and crime procedural. And ER is, I mean, it was created by Michael Crichton, a former doctor himself, much like George Miller, director of Mad Max, who created Mad Max off his own experiences working in the emergency rooms and seeing what was coming in. And Michael Crichton's ER, I mean, it still holds up. I mean, it's a very 90s series, so some of the outfit in that's a bit outdated, but it's just such a interesting, fast-paced series, and seeing the dynamic between this overworked staff of, like, a Chicago emergency room. Especially the fact that you see people riding the gurneys and doing CPR is just something we never saw in British hospital dramas, and we still don't, but it's something exciting to see, and I'm really enjoying this revisit to ER. On the more newer end of things, Unreal was returned finally for season 4, which we've talked about it a fair few times here on the show. I mean, it's a really great drama. It's probably one of the best things to justify having an Amazon Prime subscription, especially because I've yet to warm to any of their own projects, unlike like the Netflix originals. Whenever Amazon Prime announced that they're doing a series, it very rarely warms to my sort of interest, apart from like American Gods and Preacher. And Unreal is like one of their exclusives at the moment here in the UK, especially. And they've just launched a new season now, and this time it's a female suitor. If you're not familiar with the show, it's essentially similar to Glow, as it's all about the background behind the scenes running of a bachelor-esque show run by the ultimate female boss Quinn, and you're basically watching how the show is manipulated and how these characters are all running their own agendas behind the scenes of the show. This season hasn't been given us so many controversial moments as we've seen in the previous two. We're only 6 episodes in, so there's still a number of exciting things that could happen. Amongst the suitors this time, we've got the Russian alpha male who puts Captain Jack from Torchwood to shame in the fact that he sleeps with everything, like be it man, woman, beast. There seems to be nothing that he won't sleep with. And at the same time, he's just also got that nasty drug habit. So we've got a lot of interesting elements here, and we're yet to see how they all come into fruition. But if you're yet to watch Unreal, definitely check it out, especially if you've got your Amazon Prime. It's certainly one of the better things you can be using it for.
In America here, I believe it runs on Lifetime.
Yeah. It was run on Lifetime over here, but for some reason they only showed the first season, and then sort of Amazon have been the only way to pick it up. But speaking of obviously shows that and their bizarre distribution, regular listeners of the show will know that we've been kind of campaigning to see a return of Gotham to screens, and we can proudly report there's been some fruition, as Gotham is now returning to TV screens, as E4 are now going to be showing it. It was previously on Channel 5, but now they've decided that they're going to start with Season 4, which now means you've got to watch Season 3 on Netflix before you can watch Season 4 on E4. But, you know, it's good. Someone out there is listening to us and put it back on TV, so hooray for us. Other than that, I mean, Westworld's back soon. I think it's the end of the month. Westworld returns for Season 2. We've had about a year break. So take that, Game of Thrones fans, if you think you've had it bad. I mean, did you watch Westworld at all, Season 1? Or
no, it's an HBO series over here.
Yeah.
Which means it's very hard to get without an HBO subscription it's very hard to get through legal channels without an HBO subscription, which is obscenely expensive. Without even the monthly streaming, which you can get standalone, or you can get through Hulu or Amazon Prime over here, it's still something ridiculous, like $15 or $20 a month.
Wow.
I think it's on, I think Amazon Prime is selling it, but, you know, the HBO, even streaming, HBO is really notorious over here for overpriced overpriced home media sets. Mind you, they do throw in, particularly for things like Game of Thrones, they do throw in a great a lot of extras. I mean, I just can't justify, the price of on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
I think for a season of, Game of Thrones is like, $80 or something like that.
Wow. Yeah, they're really,
Even on Blu-ray, and it's, if I recall correctly, the streaming, to rent or buy the streaming is similarly, similarly kind of, expensive, more expensive than other shows. So I have not been able to watch it.
Okay. I would say that definitely if you find someone who can lend you a box set or something, definitely worth checking it out. It's worth watching. In many ways, it adds to what the original film gave us, and in many other ways, it's very much its own beast. I recently did a piece over on thatmomentin.com for my movie tourist series on Westworld, and I've sort of drawn comparisons between the two. And the series itself is obviously it's got more room, it's got a larger canvas, and it's got more money being thrown at it than the original film. So it's been able to do a lot more interesting things with the ideas. And certainly the cast is absolutely fantastic, and the plotting of the first season has been great as well. I mean, it essentially ends with the start of the uprising of the machines. And that's where it left us. But the first season itself is just going into like the backgrounds of all these characters and stuff is where it's mainly sort of focuses, and it's been an absolutely fantastic season. And certainly having Anthony Hopkins as the cast as the creator of the park, Ed Harris as the mysterious man in black, there's just been so many. It's just really been a great show, and one worth checking out. And I hope that now Game of Thrones coming to the end, more people will sort of check it out as they look for that sort of bigger budget drama sort of fix. But yeah, it's definitely one worth checking out. We just had all the previews and the sort of teasers for season two. One of the running themes of the show is that you have these stripped down versions of popular music tracks, like we had Black Hole Sun. We had Paint It Black, and they're sort of given these sort of classical reworkings to promote season two. They released a piece of music from the season, and it was Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box, which sounds absolutely fantastic. So I'm certainly looking forward to season two when that starts at the end of the month. On the more retro side of things, the Birmingham-based company over here, Kaleidoscope, are currently on the hunt for lost episodes of Doctor Who, as well as The Avengers. They're currently got this massive campaign to try and track down the missing tapes, because, I mean, like you probably know, being a Doctor Who fan, that the BBC kind of screwed up and deleted a lot of the early years of Doctor Who.
It's definitely kind of black mark on the history of the BBC. Although there is, and I could go on about this. This is having gone into this particular being a Doctor Who fan and having researched this particular facet of fandom and the history, I could actually perform like a 30-minute monologue on exactly what was going on and how it happened. But yeah, I had heard in particular because they're now, I think about 3 or 4 years ago, they had found one full serial and all but a second serial, all but one episode that were basically two of which were, I think, if I remember correctly, thought to be completely lost. And they did a kind of rush job DVD releases for those. And I think now they're going through and doing proper DVD, prepping proper DVD releases. And the guy who located these episodes is saying, yeah, he believes that they're, you know, he believes that he might be able to recover, you know, more episodes, that there are more episodes out there to get.
Yeah, I mean, these companies are really sort of, Kaleidoscope are really sort of confident in the fact that they can find these. I mean, they're looking for episodes like Doctor Who, Top of the Pops, The Avengers. There's a whole bunch of list of that there's been sort of like compiled by like TV experts and TV fans and journalists of like the shows that they were wanting to find. I mean, they've just recently unearthed this road safety video featuring Adam West's Batman. Like the 60s that he again thought to be lost, and they've recently uncovered it. So they're trying to find more at the moment. I think they've got like some Tommy Lee Jones style character there, like having them search every outhouse, hen house, penthouse, looking for these tapes. And I know that, like you were saying, they've released these episodes, and where they're missing footage, they've got animated sections, which I've yet to watch any, and so I don't know how that works at all.
Most of them aren't amazingly the animation isn't, and it's not incredible in quality. It's perfectly functional most of the time. The main thing about it does give you something. It does give you a visual reference to go along with what you're hearing. But it's interesting, but it's not it's not me. Obviously, it's not going to be Disney or Miyazaki level animation.
Okay, I mean, obviously, I have to ask. Obviously, as a Doctor Who fan, what are the missing episodes that you would most like to see?
I think just about everybody in every Doctor Who fan is going to give you about the same four serials. They're going to list, you know, Marco Polo. They're going to list the evil of the Daleks. The Daleks Master Plan are ones particularly. The Daleks Master Plan in particular has a kind of a prequel or a cutaway prequel episode. The only episode that does not feature the regular cast in Mission to the Unknown. Those would be great to have. The Evil of the Daleks is generally considered to be one of the big finds, one of the ones that people are really hoping for. Fury from the Deep is one that I would particularly like to see. A lot of the ones that are missing in some way, shape, or form are the Patrick Troughton ones. And I think those are the ones I would really like to see.
Awesome. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, hopefully they're going to come up and at least find like one or two pieces. Because it's always nice to know that the archive is being restored, even though the original Doctor Who series, I believe they're available to stream in the States, but they're not available to stream anywhere in the UK, despite it being a production.
We've got them on BritBox,
which is
over here, which it surprises me that they don't have anything like BritBox in Britain. and it is kind of like your one-stop shop. BritBox is kind of like your one-stop shop for, not just not just BBC, but also ITV stuff. Okay. But this is the perfect point at which to say one of the discoveries I just made was that they are releasing the original series now in Blu-ray box sets, starting with Tom Baker's first season. And they're going to be releasing them in the UK and in the States. And they're not doing them as individual stories. They are doing them apparently as full season box sets. So that this is kind of an interesting point at which to kind of do that. This is kind of the point at which apparently they have some faith that the physical media is not dead, or maybe they're not making enough money off of BritBox over here as you might think they were. But that those are things that are coming out. So, and they've got the DVD packages have are great. The Doctor Who, they have for the individual stories, they had great packages for the extras, and I guess the DVD, the Blu-rays are going to have all those extras plus even more new extras. So I'm looking forward to the first box set. Like I said, it's going to cover season, I think, 13 or 14, the first Tom Baker season, starting with that would be Robot Through Revenge of the Cybermen. And I've pre-ordered mine, and I'm interested to see how these are going to turn out. And they said they are working on more box sets, so my interest is they have my interest now.
I'm always interested in the original Doctor Who. I can't say I even watch the new one, so I have no idea what's happening with the new series.
Obviously, I don't know. You probably heard about this stuff over there, but Stephen Moffat has stepped down as showrunner. They're filming the new season right now. Chris Chibnall, who was the showrunner on Law and Order UK, and then did Broadchurch, was the writer of Broadchurch, is taking over as showrunner. He has done some stuff that he is not really one of the better. Some of his episodes have been okay. Some of them have not been so okay. So we're from a writing perspective, I'm a little bit cautiously optimistic. But the thing, of course, that you would even if you don't really follow the series, you would have heard of was Jodie Whittaker as the Doctor. And I'm really interested to see what her approach is going to be, and what the writing approach is going to be.
Well, no doubt. I can sponge my reports off yourself as and when that makes its return. On to the first of our selections this evening. We're going to start with the IT Crowd. If you are not familiar with the IT Crowd, it's basically a forerunner in many ways to the Big Bang Theory, in that it follows these two guys who work in the IT department, the base of this office, and they're bossed around by Jen, who knows nothing about computers at all, but the fact that they all cover for each other, because the fact that at the same time Roy and Moss, the two supposed IT experts, generally are spending their day slacking off, and the fact that any problem in the office can be solved by the notorious catchphrase, "Have you tried turning it on and off again?" This show, I mean, when it first came out, I don't think it had much of an audience, and over time it's built up its sort of cult reputation. And it's noteworthy for, obviously, being one of those shows. I mean, it's when we get into the cast and stuff, you see that a lot of these cast members obviously went on to do other better series. This is a very British comedy. I mean, this is obviously released in 2010, this particular episode was. So it's in that sort of second wave of British comedy. What is it about the IT Crowd that really appeals to yourself?
Yeah. IT Crowd, I always like to call the IT Crowd Big Bang Theory done right.
Yeah.
I've never liked the Big Bang Theory. I find it very kind of condescending in its portrayal of quote unquote nerds and quote unquote nerd culture. It's definitely not, unlike IT Crowd, and unlike Community, it's definitely not written with kind of like an insider's, with a whole lot of, I felt, inside knowledge. Just even looking at the set of IT Crowd, it's like, just billions of Easter eggs behind the characters, like an old Altair 4400 computer, or guided by voices posters, or stuff like that. this is, I think, really a show that works off of its. It is very British. It is, I think, but on the other hand, I think there's a sort of particularly its tendency more so in the earlier episodes to basically mock corporate nonsense and bullshit speak, which is universal. I don't think that that's anything that's specific to England or to the Western world, and to kind of like mock in general the whole, you know, corporate culture and these sorts of things, how Roy and Moss, Roy and Moss are, they don't really seem to do a whole lot of work. I always think that there's a line that Chris Morris has in the pilot where he talks about how the IT department is a bunch of sexy people doing sexy things and not actually doing much work. And obviously, you know, you can do, you know, take that as it is, but it's like just kind of like watching these kind of like these characters and seeing how they kind of navigate this sort of bizarre corporate culture and just kind of like these sorts of weird kind of cultural things. The running jokes about Jen and Roy's love life. However, you know, Roy couldn't date to save his life, or the one episode that where Jen gets involved with a man who acts exactly like a stage magician and has the name Peter File.
Yeah. Pedophile. There's so many elements of this show. I mean, as you said, it is Big Bang done right in many ways. I mean, you've got Richard Arioldi, who plays Moss, who's like the brains of the operation, and he's at the same time extremely self-confident. He lacks any sort of confidence at all, and he'd rather just hide out in the basement working on his various projects and things. And then you've obviously got Chris O'Dowd, who likes to see himself as being one of the popular kids, but at the same time he's sort of hindered by the fact that, like Moss, he's just really into all these like nerdy things, and at the same time just kind of a slob, kind of useless, and the only thing he seems to excel at is finding ways not to do any work. And Jen is kind of, she's the sort of corporate go-getter who through some turn of events has ended up in the basement with these two IT guys, and she's desperately trying to work her way back up into the upper echelons. And the first series had Chris Morris as the boss, and it's basically Chris Morris doing Chris Morris. And at the start of season two, it opens with him throwing himself out the window and being replaced by Matt Berry, who I always found kind of awkward in the IT crowd. I don't know about yourself. He always seemed to be like trying to overplay the funny aspects of it, where everyone else is sort of playing it a little more sort of subtle. And I think if you're a fan of Black Books, then you would certainly get the IT crowd, because all it does is basically transfers books and books in sort of like literature and that sort of crowd.
Yeah, it's not as misanthropic, I think, as Black Books, but Graham Linehan, who created the IT crowd, he also co-created Black Books and wrote much of the first season. And there's actually some overlap of the jokes. There's an episode I remember of Black Books where Fran dates a man who's gay, but both of them completely refuse to accept that he's gay. And some of these jokes were kind of rehashed, I shouldn't say rehashed, but kind of like borrowed in a second season episode where Jen dates a guy who is so closeted that he doesn't realize that he's gay, even though he takes Jen to see a gay musical. That sort of thing. But yeah, it is, there are quite a few parallels between the two series.
Yeah, but definitely. So,
As for Matt Berry, this was the first thing I saw Matt Berry in, and everything I've seen Matt Berry in, he has more or less, even if he's playing like various characters as he does in Snuffbox, which we're going to get to later, at least one character is going to be a variation on this character. To the point that it was actually, when I actually saw an interview with Matt Berry, I was absolutely gobsmacked to find out that he actually doesn't talk like this in real life. I recently watched the movie Moon with Sam Rockwell, where Matt Berry has like a supporting role as kind of like a corporate drone, and he doesn't play it as broadly or comically as he plays Douglas, but it's still he's still using that exaggerated voice. And that's, like I said, that's just something I just associate Matt Berry with, period. Even in things that he has been doing more recently, it's pretty much the same way he plays the character he plays in Toast of London.
Now, at the same time, they've got Joiningham and sort of occasionally brought out. They have a cupboard at the back of their IT department, which no one is ever supposed to open. And in there, they've got another of the former workers from the offices above, who, after becoming goth, got banished down to the IT department as well, where he's forced to watch the light on the servers. Who's played by
Richmond?
Yeah, Richmond. And the fact that his whole role in it, the fact that Moss and Roy basically treat him like he's one of the monsters from Trapdoor. The fact that he's never supposed to come out of the room. And
what is Richmond doing out of his room? You neglected to tell us who plays him.
This is because I can't remember the name of the actor who plays him.
Noel Fielding.
Exactly. There we go.
From the Booch. Yeah.
So I think this again is like, when we look at this, this is very much like The Young Ones in the fact that you have all the top sort of British comedians of this particular period, or will appear in one way or another, the same way that they did in sort of Spaced or Father Ted or Black Books and Brass Eye. You have this cross-pollination, and again, the IT crowd is no stranger to this. As Noel Fielding, as you said, he turns up, and there's this episode where they explain his backstory and how he ended up to be in the server room. And he basically shows that he like got into Cradle of Filth, and it shows he turned up at his boss's funeral in full goth makeup, and then recommended to his boss's mother that she listen to a particular track of a Cradle of Filth album to help her get over the loss of her husband. And this is all treated with this transfixed look of horror by Chris Morris's boss character at the same time, which I think only Chris Morris could pull off. Could just use a single frozen look to deter so much rage and disgust at somebody.
Yeah, but not a literal Cradle of Filth. That would be horrible. And I, apropos of nothing, and in one of my weirder moments, I conceived of a redo of the pilot episode of The X-Files, where the characters were introduced like they were introduced on the IT crowd. And I imagined Mulder as Richmond being banished down to the office at the bottom. It's like, here's me catching Monty props in 1986. But yeah, it is one of those where I know Alice Lowe had done an episode of IT Crowd and several others. In the episode I watched, there was a guy, I don't think it was Rob Brydon, but he looked exceptionally like Rob Brydon.
Well, another interesting aspect of the IT Crowd is that normally when we have these ensemble sort of comedies, they're all, the whole trio will be involved in the one storyline. And where the IT Crowd obviously differs is the fact that each of these characters will often have their own sort of plot thread that they follow for an episode. And certainly in the episode I watched, Talent for Beginners, each of the characters are off on their own sort of little thread, and it somehow manages to find a way to balance out the time between these characters. So it's there's no sort of like obvious A, B, or C plot for the episode. And as you mentioned already, like, I mean, there's a lot of sort of geeky aspects that we see with like the Big Bang Theory that the IT crowd, and it just doesn't better, such as the fact that there's an episode where Roy and Moss are using an app so that they can tend to be more blokish. And
did you see that Lady Christmas fly last night?
And there's, I think it's the same episode, they go to football because the blokes are supposed to enjoy it, and she does have Moss there going, "Oh, and he's kicked the ball. Isn't that exciting?" And I'm sitting there going, finally, someone is saying what football is, because I hate football.
I particularly like to watch British Premier League soccer, but like you and Jay Cluett, that's how I imagine you watch football.
Oh, yeah. If I'm forced to watch it, I will reenact the whole Moss thing. I would just go, and he's kicked the ball. Well, that's exciting, isn't it? Just provide this like very monotone like commentary until they like even let me go somewhere else and punch me. So one of the two happens. I find that, you know, people's fear of the unknown often turns into violence. So.
Yeah.
But I think when we certainly look at Big Bang Theory, and I mean, this is something I was meaning to bring up earlier, and the fact that certainly with the Big Bang as it is at the moment, I'm watching it kind of like this show I shouldn't be watching. It feels almost like this dirty secret to say you're still watching The Big Bang, because these characters have now drifted so far from what they were in the early seasons, and certainly in the character of Raj, who is now so disgusting in his sort of sexism and his general approach to how women should be treated and viewed, is just absolutely, it's just no longer the show that it originally was, where it was just like the four nerdy guys and the hot neighbor. Now they've all got girlfriends, they've all essentially got careers, and there is no struggle for these characters anymore. And a sitcom should never reach the point where there is no struggle for your characters. No one should be comfortable. We saw it in the later seasons of Friends, what happened when all the characters were essentially comfortable. They were all sort of paired up and in good jobs and stuff. There was no real problems for them to overcome, and that's why it sort of faltered in those later seasons compared to the sort of sharpness of the early seasons, where they're all sort of making their way in the world.
The example I like to use is, I haven't really watched any recent Big Bang Theory, but someone was telling me recently about a basically like a joke on the Big Bang Theory, where it's just basically Sheldon. Oh, somebody makes a sexual innuendo, and Sheldon, as an autistic nerd, doesn't get it. Ha ha ha! Let's all laugh at the nerd. Where that seems to be the entirety of the joke, and I always compare that to an early joke in the first season of the IT Crowd, where Jen is talking about getting her period. And it's just this brilliant thing where she's using all these euphemisms to talk about her getting her period. And Moss is taking all of this literally. It's like, it's that time. It's like my Aunt Irma is coming to visit. What do you not like, your Aunt Irma? Now, it's that time of the month. Oh, does she revisit on the weekend? It's high tide. I don't understand. I've fallen into for euphemisms for menstruation, I think fallen to the communists is pretty brilliant. They do have some persuasive arguments until Roy just looks at Boss and says, "Boss, Carrie, first scene in Carrie." And this is just one of the best Richard Iotti bits ever. It's like, oh, yeah. And then he starts back, no. Where it just seems a little bit more human than, oh, look at the nerd who doesn't get a sex joke.
I think the best part of that episode you're mentioning, though, is the fact that Moss mentions it to the rest of the IT community, who, like him, fully don't understand the situation and believe that men can have periods and go on mass riots because they suddenly can't control their hormones.
Yes. Now, that was, yeah, that's definitely one of the best things about that episode.
So, yeah, I think the IT crowd, it was certainly doing a lot of that sort of nerdy humor beforehand. At the same time, there was a lot of fun ideas that it was sort of exploring on its own, such as, like, the conversations between Roy and Moss, where they're talking about being, if they were, like, serial killers, what their trademarks would be. And Moss is like, oh, I call myself the Garner because I leave a rose at the scene of every crime. And Roy's like, well, what's your chosen weapon going to be? And he's like, pauses for a minute. And he's like, a hammer. I mean, this is also a show where we see a clown being beaten to death with his own squeaky shoe.
It just got these, some of these wonderful, absurd moments. There was one episode, I think it's in the second series, about Jen and smoking, where the smoking area gets binged further and further away, gradually further and further away, and finally, you know, by the time it, you know, it's like the smoking area for the office is like a mile away in this sort of wasteland, and it's shot and presented as if it was like a Tarkovsky film. You know, and they're literally talking about things as if they were like, it's sort of like, you know, like Soviet, I mean, kind of things are breaking down type stuff. It was just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, we mentioned already about the sort of that classic trademark line, have you tried turning it on and off again? And something that I love about the IT crowd is that it knows that its audience are smart enough to follow along with a joke. So they spend the whole first season like establishing the fact that nobody knows anything about IT by these guys, and they're always very simple fixes, such as the fact nobody's plugged in the computer or the fact they just turn it on and off again. So by the time we get into the second season, Roy no longer answers the phone. He's got an answer machine, which basically just gives the only response. So the person thinks that he's actually talking to Roy, but he's not. It's just a machine while he's off busy, you know, fanny-assing around with whatever he's interested in. I mean, there's this episode where they come down and the computer's on fire and they put a green screen on the front of it and tell him it's a screensaver.
I don't think they tell him it's a screensaver. They just pretend it's a screen, and he just decides, you get what they're trying, and I'm sitting here like, what are they trying to do? And Renham just comes down, or what was his name, the Chris Morris character, says, oh, great screensaver.
So yeah, I think if you haven't,
yes sir, I'm Adam. Fire! Exclamation point. Fire! Exclamation point. Looking forward to hearing from you, Morris Moss.
I mean, I love Chris Morris, and I think that his boss character was certainly one of the best things. I think Matt Berry's sort of replacement for the character wasn't as strong. I mean, he had some good moments. I mean, they did a whole play on the secrets. I think all these characters have the moments to shine, which makes them so great. And I think, same with the trio, they just constantly find new ways to work with these characters. I think there's an episode where Moss gets trapped in Jen's office because of spiders between him and the door. And all this is done just for him shouting out to Jen. Just this conversation where he's clearly trying to prove that he's not scared of this spider, but at the same time clearly panicked and overwhelmed by the fact this tiny spider's in the way.
Another really good one is one where Moss invents a new bra for Jen. Jen's, something's wrong with Jen's bra, so he invents this like new kind of bra for Jen, and you have this sort of like branching plot where he ends up taking it to Moss ends up taking this new design for a bra to I don't remember what you call it in Britain, but in America we call it Shark Tank, where they have to, you have an entrepreneur, an inventor come up, and they have to justify their thing and give this pitch to like these millionaire investors. And meanwhile, a design flaw in the bra resulted in just one of the best non sequitur lines of the entire series. Just this one scene of Jen screaming, "My tits are on fire!" in front of a bunch of people who think she means something else.
Yeah. I mean, you could just even we just look at Roy trying to figure out how his girlfriend's parent died in a fire at SeaWorld.
Yeah.
And his way to do it is to build his own little replica of SeaWorld and set it on fire in front of his desk. And you just see him with this model ablaze. And he's like, oh, now I see where it was. But yeah, I would say if you like British comedy, then IT Crowd still totally holds up.
Oh, it does.
Certainly, if you want something similar to like the early seasons of Big Bang, you like your nerdy humor, then it more than delivers. And at the same time, it doesn't sell out the same way that Big Bang has. But you know, that's what happens. You pay the big bucks, someone's got to give. Although I still maintain, to fix Big Bang, all they need to do is kill Raj. But I think that falls into like a moral gray area. So, yeah, that would be how you do it. You kill Raj, and then the following season is who killed Raj. So,
okay,
that's the only way I can see. That's the only way to go, because Raj at the moment is the weakest character. All the other characters have evolved, and he's just become just disgusting in his attitudes, and he just becomes extremely grating to watch. Especially as they, at one point, they had him, his character figured out. He was going to embark on a gay relationship with Stuart, the comic book guy, and that would bring those two characters together. They would find comfort and companionship with each other, having felt struck out with women. They would discover homosexuality was be like the way to go. But I think they chickened out because they seemed to be leading up to that, and then they suddenly backed out of it. So I don't know what happened there, but
cowards.
Yeah. I know. But we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we're going to be looking at the second of our Matt Berry entries for this evening as we look at Snuffbox.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we're going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com, or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
And we're back. You, of course, are still listening to TV Good Sleep Bad on the ThatMomentIn.com podcast network. If you haven't done already, please do click like or subscribe. Make sure you follow us. You can get the full archive for the show on ThatMomentIn.com, where we are, of course, a proud member of the podcast network. And we are also available on both Podomatic and iTunes as well. We are now on to the second selection this evening. This was a show picked by Lackey, and it's the episode Snuffbox, which was a Matt Berry comedy. I mean, I'd never heard of Snuffbox, I think mainly because it's a BBC comedy. But Lackey, what is it that appeals to you about Snuffbox?
Okay, to give you a little bit of a rundown on what Snuffbox is, it's a sketch comedy show with a lot of recurring situations and characters. It predates Matt Berry's appearance on IT Crowd by a couple of years. It was filmed and aired in 2006. And it's him and Rich Fulcher, who I'm proud to say is a Chicago local boy. Like Matt Berry, he's connected with the Mighty Boosh. And that's how they met. And basically, the situation is that Matt Berry is a Matt Berry and Rich Poulter. Their main characters on Snuffbox are like hangmen for the British government. So usually, every episode the first episode starts off without them walking down a corridor. and talking about things until they go into a room where they're reading, Ellen Ford is reading a condemned man, his last rites, and, you know, just before going and hanging him. And from there, like I said, it has a lot of recurring situations. A lot of sketches center around an exclusive gentleman's club, founded by Matt's great-grandfather, which has a door that can travel through time to the club as it was in 1888. They have a series of sketches where Matt Berry tries to play like a nice guy to an attractive woman by helping her carry something. And then when she finds out, he finds out she has a boyfriend, he violently throws down whatever he's helping her carry and screams, "Fuck you!" And walks away. One of my favorite recurring gags, which didn't appear in this one, but appears several times, other episodes, is one where Rich and Matt play producers, like record producers in like the 80s. And then Matt will go off and he'll go off stage, and then they'll bring in somebody like a fairly well-known comedian playing musical celebrity. The ones that come to mind, they had Alice Lowe as David Bowie in one, and Noel Fielding as Adam Ant in another. And then Matt comes back, does not recognize the celebrity, and just insults them all to hell. They do an old Grey Whistle Test parody, and just various other sketches like that. This is, again, we talk about the Monty Python and the Young Ones and the sort of spirit of anarchy. And this is a really, it has these recurring bits, but this is a sort of episode, a show where you're going to, at various points, you know, if you're watching with someone, you're going to turn to that person and say, is it just, did I imagine that they did that? You know, the in this particular episode, which is called Oh Brothers, the central, the A plot, such as it is that Rich and Matt's brothers come and visit them, and Rich's brother is a complete sort of angry, like a ugly American lout wearing a t-shirt that says "fuck you," and Matt's brother is a self-taught musician with 80% hearing loss, who talks like he's talking and screaming into a ceiling fan. But like I said, there's all these various sort of diversions, and you know, the one really sort of did they just do that bit is there's like the general, you know, the character, Matt Berry's character of himself that he plays throughout the series is basically shown to be just basically a complete and utter reprehensible misogynist. But there's this one scene where he's seen taking out a woman to dinner, and Rich Fulcher comes in playing some sort of other character and says to him, it's like, I comes up and says, "I know you from somewhere. Do you play organized softball? Paintball? I know! You raped me!" And he's just going through this whole thing, like, "You raped me, and then you took me after the park, and you raped me again, and you were just ramming it in, ramming it in, ramming it in." And in front of this, "Oh, I see you're on a date." The only time he stopped was to take a squig of whiskey, and that's the thing that offends the woman, because he had told her that he was a teetotaler. It's the punchline of this whole thing. But I'm just sitting there. I remember watching this show, and there was nobody else in the apartment. I just looked over at the cat and said, "Did they just do that?" But it was just like, "You raped me." You know, and it's that's the other kind of thing that I really enjoy about it. This is really, really dark humor.
Yeah.
You know, the thing where they had in this particular episode, the bit about being the hangman sketch they did in this one was the conceit of the episode is Rich's birthday. So he gets, while they're actually trying to hang someone, he gets a call on the line that everybody is only gets used when the queen wants to pardon, or the prime minister wants to pardon someone. But somehow Rich's sister got that phone number and is wishing him a happy birthday. And he had to be, yeah, just go ahead and hang that guy. And again, on top of that, you have Alan Ford playing this cussing Anglican priest giving the last rites. So it's fucking hilarious. I don't think I've ever seen a comedy show, a sketch comedy show, quite like it. So I will now turn things over. What's your impression of Snuffbox?
You know these moments when you're watching this and you wonder, what are the normal people doing on the Friday evening? When you're sitting there like trying to think, how am I supposed to take this and then go onto our podcast as a semi-respectable journalist of cult TV goodness and then explain to people what the hell this show was about? And at the same time, I realized as well that is shows like this, and particularly discoveries like this, that I know the reason that we do this show, because this was absolutely fantastic. I think the closest I can compare it to would be Mr. Show. If you like Mr. Show, I think you like Snuffbox, because they're very similar in the style of the fact that they start off an idea and they go off on another little tangents are in the world. Certainly, if you've ever wondered what our recording studio looks like, then you can see it in the Gentleman's Club for Hangman, seen in this episode, as this is how we record all our episodes.
Yes.
Drinking whiskey and sitting in nice, leather, high-backed armchairs, especially now we're got on the thatmomentin.com rupees.
Especially since you know, our association with That Moment In, they've allowed us to kind of monetize the podcast, and we've now been able to afford the no jokes about the Queen sign,
exactly.
Warning sign that I've always felt we've needed, that just really, that really kind of completes the vibe of our set.
This is one of those shows where you have to kind of let it just wash over you. And I think if you do that, then you enjoy it a lot more than trying to sit there questioning everything. I mean, we open to Matt Berry and Rich Fulcher, and they're walking down this white hallway. And they come to the end, and while they're walking along, they're having this random conversation. There's another episode, I think it's the episode before this, where they're going along and Rich Fulcher's character is talking about how he had to go to the vet to have a tooth removed because it was like the size of a rabbit. And the fact that he'd read this issue of Cosmopolitan, and Matt Berry opens the door and throws him through. And next thing we see, he's falling into a swimming pool and then surrounded by these gorgeous synchronized swimmers. And his only response to it is, "Oh, hello, ladies. Do you read Cosmopolitan?" And I was like, there's something about that just really appeals to my the kind of comedy that I like. But yeah, the fact we have these two hangmen hanging around a gentleman's club, just drinking whiskey and discussing the matters of the day. And we have the random asides. In this particular episode, we have various celebrities who have sidelines in fixing office equipment. So we have Charlie Manson turns up to fix the coffee machine. We have Elvis fixes a printer. And we have David Beckham, who turns up to fix a computer monitor, but all he does is kick a football at it.
And the thing that I think really makes that those sketches to me are just basically how they do nothing. It's just like Rich Fulcher, who plays all three roles, he just basically manages to like get the drinks machine fixed by the printer fixed by just like doing like a little bit of Elvis shtick and just finally pointing and it goes beep. And then one of the other things I thought was hilarious about those sequences is Matt Berry doing this doing his character in a West, I think it's a Midlands accent that is like straight out of the League of Gentlemen.
Yes.
It's like, if I had my eyes closed, I would have thought it was Steve Pemberton doing those lines.
Yes, it's a very Northern sort of accent. And if you look at his hand, it's frozen so that he's constantly giving the finger.
Yeah.
For no apparent reason, which is just so stupid. We mentioned already Matt Berry's character's brother turns up and he's deaf. And the fact he's described as being totally useless. When they're just coming in and they're doing like a drinks order, and we obviously have the loud American there, and in fact he's constantly got all these like mini bottles of booze that he's stolen from the plane or whatever, and he's just like pours them out at any given opportunity whenever anyone wants a drink. While we have had the wild transitions, I'm glad you explained the time travel angle, because I had no idea what was going on there.
Yeah.
The fact we walk in a room and we have, as you said, you have Matt Berry's sort of ancestor there, and he's got another guy with a gun to his head.
His servant Wormwood.
Okay.
Who I think the guy who plays Wormwood, I think he also showed up on Dark Place.
Okay, yeah.
I think he was the orderly on Dark Place.
I mean, this is... it's about 30 minutes long, this episode is, so it's not especially long, but it crams more... like Mr. Show, it crams in so many... I'm not sure if they're interesting ideas, they're certainly ideas. It throws a lot of ideas out of the screen, and it's just... it's never dull. It's always entertaining. I mean, you mentioned already we've got the hanging, which is obviously... which they're more interested in celebrating his birthday than they are the actual job they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if anything, this made me want to go back and watch the rest of it. I mean, it's only a 6-episode run.
Right.
And they only did one series, so...
It's the perfect run, it's the perfect length for something like this. The weakness of this, the weakness that it does have is that you have to build up a tolerance to these jokes, because they're going to make them over and over and over. You're going to see out of these, there's like a number of like recurring gags that are going to show up like 4 episodes out of every 6. Rigging the entire episode so that Rich and Matt end up at the end. The very last sketch of the episode is them singing the theme song. Shows up all the time. Matt and the girlfriend and Fuck You shows up like 4 episodes. Matt's attempts to buy golden cowboy boots from a retailer where he just gets beaten up every time shows up just almost every episode. The two record producers, the old gray whistle test jokes, which is, this is the one of the reasons I picked this, is this has got the best old gray whistle test riff with Richard Iowati coming in as the host, and it's Matt Berry's brother. And when Matt Berry's brother sings, he just basically sounds like a theremin or guitar feedback, which is it's hilarious. But you're going to have to build up like a tolerance to these recurring jokes, because you're going to be hearing them over and over and over. That by the by about the 6th episode, if you binge the series, by about the sixth episode. You think that you're thinking to yourself, yes, if I never hear anybody go whiskey again in my life, that'll be fine.
It's I'm glad you mentioned the old gray whistle test, because I completely forgot about it. I mean, are you familiar with the actual show, the old gray whistle test?
Yes, for the most part. I'm not, it's not something I'm amazingly familiar with, but it's things I've seen. Like, I know what it, I've known what it was, and I know that it's, it was a live kind of, like, prog, or sort of, like, more rock-oriented. It wasn't really, like, Top of the Pops.
Yeah, it was, it was an alternative to Top of the Pops, that basically where they, as you said, they may played a lot of, like, more rock and prog, and sort of more experimental sort of music, and it was hosted by Whispering Bob Harris.
Uh-huh.
Who is now on? He's on Radio 2. He presents a country music radio show, and his whole thing is that he just spoke very quietly, and that he spoke very calmly. And Richard Adioli, obviously playing the role. I think he's the only person who could really sort of play that role. And I think he really sort of nails the mannerisms of Whispering Bob Harris in the scene we obviously see it, and it was just so random to see, of all the things that they reference the old grey whistle test, because it's, as I said, it's not something you would see you would expect to see. But then again, you wouldn't expect parts of the Snuffbox theme to be used in Dread.
Yeah.
Which I found out when I was doing the research for this. So.
Snuffbox really does show a lot of Matt Berry's various kind of obsessions. Because I've also been following Matt Berry is also a musician. He's recorded several albums of quirky, very distinctly English kind of 70s style psychedelia. Almost the sort of thing, like, I've never heard the band Steel Eye Span, but it's what I imagine Steel Eye Span sounds like. This sort of, like, pastoral kind of British, 70s pastoral, just a little bit post-hippie with just a little pinch of glam and a little bit of distortion. And that's very much kind of obvious. His interest in that is very, very much where I think the old Grey Whistle Test parodies come from. Because that was the sort of thing that, to my understanding, that old Grey Whistle Test would, have artists like, that was where you would go for, what you would have called alternative at the time if you had wanted, to see like a Fairport Convention or a Barclay James Harvest type thing, or like prog rock from America type stuff. That would have been like the show to go to. I think that's kind of, you get a clearer view of what his kind of obsessions are. So it's not quite, if you know a little bit about Matt Berry's other extracurricular activities, not quite, makes a little bit more sense. And just their kind of, this kind of interest, there's just kind of, I think, a lo-fi 70s type quality in general to it. There's this sort of retro, I think, but just kind of feeling kind of running through Snuffbox. Which again also connects it to Dark Place.
But yeah, I mean, that's all I can really say about this. I mean, it's one that you have to go out and sort of experience. If any of our what we've discussed about it makes it sounds interesting to you at all, I'd definitely say check it out. Especially if you're a fan of warped comedy. So if you're like a John Waters fan, or you're a fan of, as like you said, of like Monty Python and a Mr. Show. I think this would certainly be a show that you'd really, really get a kick out of, because it contains so many of those elements. But yeah, I'd certainly enjoyed it. I think this is going to be another of those shows that becomes another obsession for me, like when you got me hooked on Always Sunny in Philadelphia, only this time It's not going to be like 400 episodes of a show that I'm going to have to sit and work through.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, in many ways, Snuffbox is, I think, the sort of show that what we're doing here is absolutely, perfect to discuss a show like Snuffbox.
Yeah,
it is the epitome, I think, of kind of like and really kind of like the acts, the comedic axis that includes like Matt Berry, Richard Iowati, Noel Fielding, Julian Barrett, Matt Holness, Alice Lowe, etc., is just perfect. These are like the epitome of the British cult comedies.
This brings us to the end of another edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. We hope you've obviously enjoyed it. If you've not done already, please do like, comment, hit that subscribe button. Whether you listen to us on Podomatic or iTunes or through our partner site, thatmomentin.com. We also have a Facebook group, so look us up on Facebook and let us know what you think of the show. Let us know shows you would like to see us discuss. We always appreciate the feedback. On the next episode, though, Lackey, what would you like to look at?
One of the this is a very topical and timely choice of mine, and something that another show that I really wanted to do from the get-go of the inception of this, and it's really, I'm glad I kind of waited to bring this particular show up, because it really is, I think, probably more relevant now than it was when it originally ran in the, I think, the late 90s. In the era of fake news, the weirder, more prescient shows that foretold the rise of fake news And again, it involves one of the comedians that we've mentioned today, Chris Morris's Brass Eye. And the episode we are going to be looking at is, we are not going to be looking at the Pete Geddon episode. I do want to keep our listeners. I do want to keep our affiliations. We're going to be looking at an episode called Drugs.
Cool. For myself, still keeping on the British comedy slant, we're going to be having you look at an episode of the British Asian comedy series Goodness Gracious Me, the second episode of series one. This is a sketch comedy with an all British Asian cast. Some of the names you probably recognize are like Sanjeev Bhaskar, Meera Shenoy, and Nina Wadia, who've all gone on to bigger things since the show. But when this show came out, it was, as I said, it was a representative way of parodying how ideas of from Asian culture, in particular the Pakistani style of culture, and how British attitudes to Indian life were. In particular, the show is most famous for giving us the Going Out for an English sketch, which was a parody of how British people act in Indian restaurants. This particular episode, I'm not going to obviously reveal too much about it, but one of the key skits of it features a skit called the 5 million rupee man. Sadly, this episode doesn't feature their play on Skippy the bush kangaroo, where they basically redub an episode to Skippy, so it becomes Skipinder the Punjabi kangaroo, and spends all the episode being drunk. But as always, I'd like to thank my co-host Daniel Lackey for joining me.
Whiskey!
And until next time, this is Edward Jones signing for another edition of TV Ghostly Bad. Remind you, as always, to keep it strange.